Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 67. It's Friday, June 18th, and I'm coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Let's start with a local update on COVID-19. Lucas County cases are still low compared to a month ago, but local hospitalizations and deaths have not decreased proportionally. Anyone who has been out and about can witness for themselves that mask wearing is not the norm for people visiting businesses. Plus, larger gatherings are becoming more and more common. Testing has been opened up to anyone who wants to get a test, and the good news, testing sites have not yet met their capacity yet. Since Lucas County has been reporting test numbers since May 20th, we can compare that with the state number of tests, and the testing in Lucas County is only about three quarters the rate of what the Ohio testing rate is, and Lucas County's rate is only about half of the national rate of testing. So we have a way to go relative to others, but it seems at this point, if you want to get a test, it's possible, but there might be some questioning about how well targeted it is. Okay, there is good news in Lucas County looking at long-term care facilities, which has been a real problem for the number of cases and particularly driving a number of deaths. The total cases from two previous weeks ago was 312. That dropped down to 220. The previous week, and then the most recent week, it's dropped down to 115, so almost in half from the previous week. This is very good. Okay, well, let's take a look at another high-risk population, those in prisons. Okay, this from The Hill. Coronavirus deaths up 73% in U.S. prisons in past month. Coronavirus deaths in U.S. prisons have reportedly increased by 73% since mid-May, resulting in a total of more than 600 virus-related prison deaths during the pandemic. The infection rates in prisons and jails in the county have jumped in recent weeks as the rate remains relatively stable nationwide, the New York Times reported, adding that the number of prison inmates confirmed to be infected has doubled in the past month to more than 65,000. The five largest known clusters of the virus domestically are within corrections institutions instead of nursing homes or meatpacking plants. The newspaper noted that. Within other sectors, like the meat processing industry, plants have been closed for more intensive cleaning, and in nursing homes, testing has increased in efforts to avoid large outbreaks. And also, regarding prisons, this from Health Affairs, incarceration and its disseminations, COVID-19 pandemic lessons from Chicago's Cook County Jail. Jail and prisons are major sites of the novel coronavirus infection. Many jurisdictions in the United States have therefore accelerated release of low-risk offenders. Early release, however, does not address how arrest and pretrial detention practices may be contributing to disease spread. Using data from the Cook County Jail in Chicago, Illinois, one of the largest known nodes of COVID-19 spread, we analyzed the relationship between jailing practices and community infections at the zip code level. We find that jail cycling is a significant predictor of COVID-19 infection, accounting for 55% of the variance in case rates across zip codes in Chicago and 37% of the variance in Illinois. By comparison, jail cycling far exceeds race, poverty, public transit utilization and population density as a predictor of the variance in cases. The data suggests that cycling through Cook County Jail alone is associated with 15.7% of all documented cases, and in Illinois, 15.9% as of April 19th, 2020. Our findings support arguments to reduce reliance on incarceration and for related justice reforms, both as emergency measures during the present pandemic and as sustained structural changes vital for future pandemic preparedness and public health. Okay, well, looking at Ohio data, to get an idea how risky it is to be an Ohio prisoner versus somebody who's not imprisoned in Ohio, Ohio prisoners have about a 250 times greater chance of dying from COVID-19 than the average Ohioan. 1.9% of state correctional inmates died of those that tested positive. 40% of those that were tested were positive. This is really high. I mean, even early in the epidemic when it was the worst, you'd see like 15% of the number of people tested being positive. Although I might note that in Arizona, it's like 17% right now. Yikes. But 40% of those tested positive is very high. Partly that might be because there isn't necessarily as good testing in facilities as there might be out for people who are not incarcerated. But Ohio has done some large-scale testing because we had the single largest outbreak of COVID-19 in the entire country in the Marion County Correction Facility. Now, for the 1.9% of inmates who tested positive that died, that's compared to 0.7% of staff who died that tested positive. Now, again, those that have been tested might not be equivalent, but this suggests that inmates have about a 3 times greater chance of dying than staff. Might give you an idea of what healthcare is like in prisons. Okay, so what else is happening in Ohio? It looks like Southwest Ohio is going to be the hot spot here in the state. We've been kind of at a slow burn since reopening statewide, but we're seeing rises in cases in Southwest Ohio, the Dayton and Cincinnati region. And this article from MSN, 200 Ohio workers at Dole plant test positive for COVID-19. Nearly a quarter of all employees at a Dole fresh vegetables plant in Ohio have tested positive for the new coronavirus, the Springfield News Sun reported. At least 200 workers have contracted the virus. An employee at the Springfield plant first tested positive for COVID-19 on April 22nd. Since the start of the virus has spread at the plant, 260 Clark County residents have tested positive for COVID-19, according to the County Health Department. The plant will continue to operate, though new health and safety precautions will be implemented, a Dole spokesman told the Associated Press. Okay. Well, other Ohio news. The percent of those tested in Ohio that tested positive is trending up, even as testing numbers increase. Not surprisingly, Ohio hospitalizations are ticking upward in recent days. It looks like what's happening nationally, we're starting to see some effects of that here locally. Nationwide, we have over 20 states that are seeing case rates going up. And it looks like Arizona and Florida are the new epicenters of the nation. Pretty much the whole South and the far West are seeing increases in cases, with the exception of New Mexico. So much for the summer heat killing off this virus. Florida is particularly troubling since it is a major travel destination and has a large elderly population. People will carry infections out of this state, and it won't just be tourists. This from the New York Times. There is no work here. Migrant workers, some sick, head north. Florida's agricultural communities have become cradles of infection, fueling a worrying new spike in the state's daily toll of new infections, which has hit new records in recent days. The implications go far beyond Florida. Case numbers in places like Immokalee are swelling just as many farm workers are migrating up the eastern seaboard for the summer harvest. Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, has called the contagion in agricultural communities Florida's number one outbreak. He has also repeated the Trump administration's misleading claim that the rise in case numbers in the state should be mostly attributed to more widespread testing and not to economic reopening. Some bars and restaurants that recently opened have had to close again as employees and patrons have gotten sick. Public health officials worry that the spiking numbers in Immokalee may not remain localized for long, as migrant farm workers increasingly go north to follow the work. Thousands make the trip out of Immokalee each year, according to the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, now I want to switch gears a bit and talk about how activism is growing in journalism, the scientific community, and among healthcare workers. And finally, how this growing activism is connecting previously disparate fields of action, such as the connection between racism and climate change activism. Here at WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio, activism is in our DNA, and we strive to provide fresh perspectives that you won't hear dominating the mass media landscape. First up, from the Hill, new era of change hits newsrooms. The civil unrest racking the country has ushered in an era of activism in the news media, with a new generation of reporters advocating for social changes that have forced newsrooms to confront long-held news-gathering traditions. The New York Times and Philadelphia Inquirer ousted senior editors after their newsrooms revolted against controversial opinion pieces that ran in their papers. Axios has given permission to its reporters to march with Black Lives Matter protesters as demonstrators rather than observers. And senior editors at boutique outlets, including Refinery 29 and Bon Appetit, have lost their jobs over allegations from reporters that they oversaw a culture of racial discrimination in the newsroom. Some newsrooms already have moved to loosen strictures requiring objectivity from their reporters. Under President Trump, some reporters have become media stars for publicly clashing with his administration. But the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis police 2 weeks ago has hastened the move towards advocacy journalism, which many in the news media believe it is past time for neutrality in coverage of issues like racial justice and police brutality. I'm talking more and more to reporters who grow up using these online platforms, and they're used to being more engaged with their communities, said Brandi Collins Dexter, the senior campaign director for the progressive nonprofit group Color of Change. They're bringing to the table a shift in how we think about the news and what reporting is. That might be different from what they've learned in journalism school. It's an exciting new time for the media, and I think it is very much needed. The shift has largely been driven by younger reporters at newspapers who have leveraged their massive social media followings to push for changes within newsrooms. It's an extension of history, says Collins Dexter. The next generation pushes a former generation to a place it's never been before, and this is another example. Media watchers interviewed by The Hill and millennial reporters have been instrumental in drawing attention to racial disparities within their newsrooms. They say the lack of diversity creates a blind spot for newsrooms in the way they write about culture and race. A 2018 Pew Research study found that 77% of newsrooms are white compared to 65% of the U.S. workforce overall. Those disparities are particularly evident at the top ranks of newspapers, where senior editors are predominantly white and male. Democratic strategist Jamal Simons, the host of FYI on Instagram, said newspapers that lack diversity have less capability to report on the complete picture of a story. They should have people salted throughout the newsroom, not just in certain identifiable positions that have to do with race or gender, Simons said. Last week, the New York Times published an op-ed from Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, entitled "Send in the Troops," that has become a flashpoint in the debate about the new dynamics coursing through newsrooms. The opinion piece called on Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act, which would give him the authority to deploy troops into U.S. cities that are dealing with escalating protests over the killing of Floyd. The paper's reporters revolted, making the case that the op-ed endangered the lives of their black colleagues. Editorial page director James Bennett resigned under the pressure. The Times was pushed to address the op-ed by its younger reporters and people of color, who took to social media to warn that it put their colleagues in harm's way. They argued that a GOP senator, Cotton, has plenty of platforms to get his views out, and that the Times wouldn't and shouldn't be amplifying his message. This is kind of a point I want to make here on this show, is the people hear a lot of stuff just from the status quo in our culture and our mass media. And we see our role here as providing you something new and different. There are two sides of the story, and the other side is not told nearly enough. We do not need to retell the story, the well-worn story of the status quo, for people to get two sides of the story. That's our view, my view here. Okay, moving to scientists. This is from Scientific American. Silence is never neutral, neither is silence. Amidst hashtag Black Lives Matter protests and resounding calls for justice, many scientists, academic institutions, and science organizations remain eerily silent. While the coronavirus pandemic highlighted the importance of science and evidence, the hashtag Science Not Silent sentiments seem to stop short of extending to another major threat to people in the U.S. and around the world, systemic racism and race-based violence. Racism has permeated this country since its inception, leading to a health crisis in black and brown communities. Look no further than the impacts of COVID-19 in the United States. Black populations experience disproportionately more coronavirus diagnoses and deaths. Amid loud and justifiable calls to protect and elevate the role of science, too many scientists and scientific organizations are eerily silent on the issue of racism and social justice, issues that are embedded in the history and practice of science. Why does that matter? Because as every scientist knows, ignoring facts doesn't make them go away. Scientists live in societies and both internalize and reflect broader societal norms, just like everyone else. Every one of us brings different lived experiences, worldviews, and implicit and explicit biases to our work. Because science is still dominated by largely white and male perspectives, many scientists have the privilege to look away from discrimination and racism or avoid having to engage in conflict around these topics. Too many scientists today continue to downplay or outright erase the role science has played in perpetuating anti-black racism and violence. Scientific progress is built on racism in many cases. Ronald Fisher, a pioneer of statistics, is also a pioneer of eugenics. The HeLa cells that are so widely used in laboratories across the United States were stolen from Henrietta Lacks without her consent. The field of gynecology was born of experiments done to enslave women and children. Scientists and public health officials withheld treatment from hundreds of black men in Alabama who had syphilis in the now infamous Tuskegee experiment, just to watch what would happen as the devastating disease progressed. The fact that the NIH does not even acknowledge the problematic history of the HeLa cells on its webpages dedicated to Henrietta Lacks' legacy perfectly illustrates the refusal of science to grapple with its racist history. Ignoring science's legacy of racism or a wider culture shaped by white supremacy doesn't make scientists objective, it makes them complicit. If one of the objectives of science is to serve society, then scientists must ask themselves, which parts of society are we serving, and who is the we to begin with? Scientists love evidence, and the data show a clear problem. In 2016, only 9% and 13.5% of science bachelor's degrees were awarded to African Americans and Latinos, respectively. Okay, so 9% of African Americans and 13.5% of Latinos received science bachelor's degrees. In that same year, only 5% of recipients of doctoral degrees in science and engineering were women from underrepresented minorities. Black or African American, Hispanic or Latino, and American Indian or Native Alaskan. And men from those populations accounted for a mere 3.8%. Today, in the U.S., almost 70% of scientists and engineers employed full-time are white. For this majority, racial harassment, discrimination, and state-sanctioned violence are abstract concepts, not everyday worries. And this perpetuates a cycle. Scientists of color are unrepresented, unsupported, harassed, discredited, ignored, or pushed out. This is not only morally wrong and profoundly unfair, it is also devastating to science itself. Let's be clear. Scientific institutions must immediately get to work on rooting out anti-black racism and all forms of racism and discrimination. The pervasive silence on racism across science institutions is self-reinforcing. It creates a culture where talking about racism is actively discouraged and where black, Latinx, and indigenous scientists cannot bring their whole selves to their work. It also means science may not even be asking the right questions in the first place. For example, the evidence is clear that climate change will disproportionately affect marginalized populations, a pattern that we have seen brutally demonstrated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And yet the communities of epidemiologists, virologists, and climate scientists tasked with studying these issues or shaping and implementing policies around them are profoundly unrepresentative of those populations. The people most affected and most familiar with the underlying issues are not driving the research agenda. If we want science to help tackle our biggest challenges, from global pandemics to climate change, science institutions must train, hire, and retain Black, Latinx, and Indigenous scholars. As it stands, not only are non-white scientists leaving science, but those who remain face hostile working environments and productivity sapped by the constant trauma of the news cycle. While the uptick of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts across academic institutions and science organizations is commendable, these efforts do not actively address the root causes of the trauma and will always fall short. If scientists don't explicitly say Black Lives Matter, if they don't speak up on justice and social issues, they risk overlooking situations, discarding talent, and perpetuating toxic power dynamics. We must all hold ourselves and each other accountable to dismantle the systems of oppression that persist in our society, the very systems that claim the lives of George Floyd and countless other black people. That work should start by denouncing racial injustice and violence in no uncertain terms, but it cannot end there. What can scientists, academic institutions, and scientific organizations do? They can create robust strategies to dismantle systemic racism within your institution. Train, hire, and support scientists of color. Hire external anti-racism educators to help staff and trainees implement new practices. Require all employees and trainees to take bystander intervention training, which has been shown to be most effective in effecting true cultural change. Hire independent diversity, equity, and I forgot what DEI stands for, sorry. Everybody uses a different acronym. Diversity, equity, and inclusion consultants to assess organizational culture. Design and implement a reward system for mentorship and outreach, as those responsibilities often fall disproportionately on underrepresented members of the faculty. Require security staff to obtain regular anti-racist de-escalation training. Break contracts with local police and pledge not to call the police for nonviolent offenses. The work of dismantling institutional racism must start at home in our scientific institutions. Addressing racism in science has to include fundamentally changing the scientific institutions themselves. Anything short of this is just lip service. Silence is never neutral. Neither is science. And I would just like to add, I'm very proud to have my scientific training in public health, because the underlying philosophy of public health is rooted in social justice. In other words, inequity, which changes the distribution and determinants of disease and of health. So to understand epidemiology, the science of public health, you're basically studying justice and injustice and inequities in society. If there weren't any of those, if there were no variances in those things, then it wouldn't be really much need to study if it was all the same. But it's not. And a lot of that, of course, is based on inequities, not just, quote, natural differences between people. Okay. This up from Stat News. A reckoning for healthcare professionals. Should they be activists too? Amid the dual crises of global pandemic and reckoning with systemic racial injustice, health workers and health educators are grappling with a momentous question that hovers between personal and professional. How much of an activist should a healthcare worker be? Doctors, epidemiologists, and nurses are increasingly abandoning their characteristic reticence in favor of direct advocacy. They raised early alarms in op-eds and on cable news programs about the disproportionate toll the COVID-19 pandemic was taking on communities of color. In the wake of the killings of George Floyd, the activism has intensified. They're circulating petitions, ramping up educational outreach, and organizing sit-ins to fight police brutality and systemic racism. They're joining marches and organizing their own. More than 10,000 healthcare workers donned their white coats and scrubs to march through downtown Seattle to show support for the Black Lives Matter movement. This outpouring of activism is the most visible manifestation of years of stirrings among healthcare workers, particularly younger members of the profession, to speak out more publicly on behalf of their patients and the societal ills that shape those patients' health needs. It's a marked departure for an industry that has long implied that doctors should not play a role in social justice movements in the name of, quote, objectivity, and maybe an uncomfortable sea change for some in the profession. In interviews, more than a dozen activists who work in healthcare told STAT that publicly speaking out against racism was not just vital for society, but also a key part of healing the patients in their care. If we as physicians are really truly in this profession to heal and to help our communities be healthy, we need to be engaging beyond the doors of the clinic and the doors of the hospital, said Nathan Chomulo, a pediatrician and founding member of Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity. Edwin Lindo, a lecturer at the University of Washington School of Medicine and one of the organizers of the march in Seattle, said, "I don't even think it's advocacy. I mean, advocacy suggests that you're doing something extra. I actually think this is an obligation of physicians to do the work that changes the conditions outside of the clinic." Doctors and other healthcare workers are taught, and sometimes even required, to keep their beliefs to themselves. Some have argued that medicine should focus myopically on objective observation of biology, disease processes, cellular structures, and symptoms. Speaking out about political causes could undermine a patient's trust in doctors' medical opinion or even dampen the broader public trust in science and medicine. Physicians have some extra baggage and responsibility when they engage on any issue in the public sphere, said Ford Vox, a medical journalist and commentator who also practices brain injury medicine. "You're speaking not just for yourself, but to some extent for the profession as a whole, and that it is theoretically possible for folks to do something that demeans what it means to be a physician," he said. "It's quite possible for physicians to get themselves into trouble and do all sorts of things that are out of bounds and bring disrepute not just on them, but the really quite sacred doctor-patient relationship, and as importantly, do not violate one code of ethics in order to achieve other aims." Fox says he thinks speaking out in the current moment is, quote, "entirely valid and appropriate," and he hasn't heard of any healthcare workers stepping out of bounds. But the extra baggage has clearly informed the medical industry's perspective on protests and other forms of activism in the past. In 2011, physicians in Wisconsin were sanctioned by the State Medical Association for writing doctor's notes to excuse political protesters from their day jobs. And just 6 years ago, administrators at Brown University threatened medical students with disciplinary actions after they organized a peaceful protest in response to the deaths of Michael Brown, Philando Castillo, and Sandra Bland. But the healthcare workers who spoke with STAT said they do not believe there should be a line between provider and activist, especially with respect to social issues like racism, with its massive, well-documented effect on the health outcomes for Black people and other people of color. The idea, I think mistakenly so, was that there isn't bias that exists in medicine. It's a neutral playing field, said Estelle Williams, a surgeon at the University of Washington and one of the organizers of the march in Seattle. "People are just now understanding or coming to terms with the fact that you know that isn't the case." To be part of a clinical response without having serious critical consciousness and political education as the foundation of that clinical response is to be complicit with oppression, and systems of oppression have always, always been a part of medicine because they're a part of humanity, said Michelle Morse, a physician and one of the co-founders of the Campaign Against Racism. If anything, both Chomulo from Minnesota Doctors of Health Equity and Williams, the University of Washington surgeon, suggested the collective power and privilege physicians hold within society is an underutilized force for change. "Leveraging the title, the position of privilege, the power that I have now allows me to further elevate the voices of those who are often forgotten because they don't have the MD," Williams said. Chomulo added, "The fact that we have these two letters after our name means that for good or for bad, we go to certain tables and people will listen to us more than people who aren't physicians." This is doubly true, the healthcare worker said, during a pandemic that has claimed so many black lives at such disproportionate rates. The coronavirus pandemic has thrown the realities of racial disparities within the healthcare system into stark relief, especially for the healthcare workers in the front lines. Black Americans are dying at nearly twice the rate that would be expected based on their share of the population. In some states, they are dying three times faster. We had a public health crisis that exposed a lot of systemic and underlying racist institutions in our society, and then it kind of dovetailed right into another public health issue, which is police brutality, said Tazon Bell, a critical care and infectious disease physician at the University of Virginia. Now we're starting to see more directly that these connections are and the profound impact it has on the black and brown community. There are early signs, too, that the institutions of medicine, medical schools, hospitals, trade associations, are beginning to change with them. The American Medical Association, for example, did not issue a statement in 2013 when George Zimmerman's acquittal for the shooting of Trayvon Martin inspired the launch of the Black Lives Matter movement, or in 2014 when Michael Brown's shooting sparked protests in Ferguson, Missouri, and around the country. In the wake of George Floyd's death, however, the AMA issued a statement condemning police brutality and organized a series of discussions around health equity and how police brutality detrimentally impacts the health of black communities. Unlike in 2014, Brown University's Dean of Medicine signed onto the university president's note of support for the Black Lives Matter movement. And in Seattle, alongside the march that drew thousands of healthcare workers who wanted to affirm their support of the Black Lives Matter movement, several major University of Washington health and science schools, the schools of medicine, of pharmacy, of dentistry, of nursing, of public health, of social work, publicly offered their support too. Many of the activists, however, said the institutions of medicine still have a long way to go to combat the racism inherent in the medical field. Black Americans have been discriminated against in nearly every aspect of medicine, from medical schools to hospital jobs, and even their acceptance at major medical organizations like the American Medical Association. Physicians and other advocates have called on hospitals to directly dismantle the systemic racism within their own walls through training programs and comprehensive diversity initiatives for hiring and promotion. They've called on medical schools to distribute reparations as a recompense for their role in perpetuating slavery. And medical students, too, have pushed for a more robust curriculum that implements anti-racism training and centers health equity as a foundational framework through organizations like the Student National Medical Association. We need to look within our institutions beyond just implicit bias and beyond just recognizing, like, I need to do the work of anti-racism, first-year medical student LaShira Nolan said, but also looking at how do we change the structures that we had in place that are extremely problematic and harmful to black people, patients in our communities. The activists who spoke with STAT emphasized that their fight is also about broader structural changes to society. They also want to lend their voices to combat the social problems shaped by systemic racism, housing insecurity, food deserts, air and water pollution, that have contributed to the long histories of racial violence endemic to law enforcement and medical institutions alike. In recent petitions, healthcare workers have asked government officials to redistribute police department budgets and make public statements acknowledging that police brutality and white supremacy should be considered public health issues. And while much of their activism looks like the anti-racism activism others are engaging in around the world, there are also non-traditional forms of activism for healthcare workers, too. Many doctors, nurses, and medical students have taken part in training that helped them serve as protest medics, rushing to the front lines to help protesters who have suffered tear gas exposure or dehydration. Other physicians see their research itself as a way to inform activism. Utibe Eisen, a physician and health equity researcher at the University of Pittsburgh, published a paper in May highlighting the lack of comprehensive race, ethnicity, and language data related to COVID-19 testing, infection, and death rates. At its core, the research underscores the evidence-based facts of the disparity, he said, but just taking on the issue as its own form of engagement, he said. If I can put data on those social factors that folks are advocating for, I think that's kind of the lane and the role that I'm hoping to play, Eisen said. In some ways, the medical profession has been edging towards activism for some time, even on more political issues. Growing numbers of physicians have come out in support of Medicare for All in recent years, mobilizing rallies and marches in support of the national single-payer health insurance system. When the National Rifle Association pressured doctors to stay in their lane and not weigh in on issues of gun control, social media exploded with photos of healthcare workers treating victims of gun violence in a digital protest centered on the hashtag, "This is our lane." Much of the push towards activism has come from a younger generation of doctors and medical students. White Coats for Black Lives sprung out of student protests at medical schools in 2014 and other student groups, including the Student National Medical Association, which have facilitated workshops to train physicians to be more socially conscious and culturally competent, according to President Ososi Obo. That has put medical schools at the forefront of the debate and at the center of calls to improve the medical profession's understanding of racism. Tomas Diaz, an emergency physician at the University of San Francisco, said many medical students spend more time studying rare diseases than broader systemic factors that impact many more people. Racism is a chronic exposure that is affecting a huge number of people, just in absolute terms. So the idea that it's not something we should be studying seems silly to me, Diaz said. And while medical schools have begun to include course offerings around the social determinants of health, health justice courses are mainly student-led electives with no institutional support nor funding, according to Jennifer Tsai, a physician and founding member of the White Coats for Black Lives National Chapter. If it became very clear that a medical school is an institution required educational form around something like biochemistry or anatomy, they would never ask a group of first-year medical students to be tasked with a job of forming that education, designing a curriculum and implementing it with no other institutional resources, Tsai said. But yet that's what happens across the nation when it comes to issues of policy, equity, racism, racial equity, transgender health, women's health. Diaz also cautioned that medical schools, even the institutions of medicine alone, could not do all the work to address inequity in healthcare. If some students' first exposure to learning about racism in a very real way is in medical school, it's already too late, he said. Ultimately, solutions out of the field of medicine are not going to be sufficient. For Eisen, the health equity researcher at the University of Pittsburgh, that's precisely why healthcare workers' activism is so important. To make it clear how deep an impact racism has had on American healthcare and to try to be part of the solution. I don't know what moment will come from the death of George Floyd. I don't know what moment will come from the coronavirus crisis, he said. But I think there is a good and a big opportunity for us to expand the message towards our colleagues that this is not just a one and done moment, that this is the moment for us to truly make social justice and health seriously. And more importantly, really try and stamp out health disparities in our generation. Okay, next up, in another form of health science activism, this from Stat News. To fight COVID-19, open access to scientific publishing. To tackle the ongoing catastrophe of the COVID-19 pandemic, the biomedical research community must deploy all the tools at its disposal, especially the extensive networks of international communication and collaboration that fuel scientific discovery. Unfortunately, we are hamstrung in our use of one of the most essential tools, open access to the vast repositories of accumulated knowledge contained in the published scientific literature. Restricting access to this research, which can help scientists find tests, treatments, and even cures for COVID-19, is short-sighted and unethical, with tangible impacts on human life. Shockingly, a large fraction of the world's scientific knowledge, most of which is produced by taxpayer-funded research programs, is locked behind paywalls of private publishers that continue to argue for, quote, embargo periods and closed archives to maximize their control over access to research and their ability to profit from this control. Under this system, research papers are sequestered for a period of time behind paywalls, ensuring that only paying subscribers can read them. This embargo period can range from months to years, and in some cases, effectively last forever. Tuesday marks a long-awaited breakthrough as Springer Nature, one of the world's most important scientific publishers, seals a transformative agreement with the 10-campus University of California system. Under this agreement, everyone in the world will have free and open access to all University of California research published in more than 2,700 of Springer Nature's journals, and all University of California students, faculty, and researchers will gain access to more than 1,000 journals to which the system did not previously subscribe. Not all steps towards open access to the scientific literature have been successful. Since a breakdown in negotiations between universities and the publishing giant Elsevier over subscription prices and freer access, large sectors of the biomedical research community, including the entire University of California system, have been denied access to vital research results contained in hundreds of scientific journals owned by that company. MIT announced last week that after reaching a similar impasse, it had called off its own negotiations with Elsevier over open access. Elsevier is, it must be noted, enjoys steady profit margins in the range of 37%. Eat your heart out, pharmaceutical companies. Government science advisors and other public advocates recently convinced some publishers to make some COVID-19 related content freely available, but that is not enough. The next breakthrough in the pandemic may well come from work not originally recognized as being related to COVID-19, and a vast amount of this scientific research remains locked away. This includes work on serum testing, viral replication, understanding coronavirus life cycles, and much more. The COVID-19 crisis merely highlights an acute form of a more chronic and systemic problem. Scientific research has a fundamental role in finding solutions to many of the pressing problems facing the world today. From cancer to climate change, and progress on all these fronts is slowed when access to the latest research as well as archives is unnecessarily restricted. On behalf of more than 100 active biomedical researchers, we urge the scientific publishing industry to open its store of scientific knowledge, which the research community has entrusted to it, and make this knowledge available to the world. If not, the government that funded this work should declare eminent domain over these materials and demand immediate, unimpeded access. It would be the ethical thing to do. Well, my friends, that is just another good example, or bad example, depending how you look at it, on the perversities that are created in our human culture by capitalism. The need to profit off that which is necessary for the public good, thereby restricting its access and diminishing all of us except for a few who make grand profits.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning. Use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, and to expand the discussion even more, this from NBC News. Why I Can't Breathe is resonating with environmental justice activists. The death of George Floyd in police custody sparked a movement that has focused national attention on institutional racism that permeates nearly every aspect of society, and that includes climate change. Now, climate activists and scientists say a similar reckoning needs to happen in the environmental movement, which experts say has had a long, uneasy relationship with racial politics. There's a level of racism in the movement itself, where some folks think that talking about these issues is a distraction, said Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Nobody is donning a white hood, but the racism is and implicit bias is evident. Elevating racial justice issues within the environmental movement has been a struggle, Patterson said, despite what the science shows about which communities are at most risk from climate change. A landmark 2018 federal report found that low-income communities are more likely to be exposed to pollution and other environmental hazards. The study also noted that some communities take longer to recover from natural disasters, such as flooding and hurricanes. A 2019 report co-authored by the Natural Resources Defense Council analyzed data from the Environmental Protection Agency and found strong correlations between the racial makeup of communities and their access to safe drinking water. In a 2013 study published in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives, found that Black Americans are 52% more likely than white Americans to live in urban heat islands, putting them at increased risk during heat waves. Yet, racial issues haven't always been at the forefront of climate debates. The people most responsible for climate change historically, globally, as well as domestically, are not the same people who are feeling the pain first, worst, and longest, said Robert Bullard, a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University in Houston. If you're just talking about greenhouse gases and parts per million, you're not seeing the issues around vulnerability and justice. Bullard is a leading voice in the field of environmental justice, which advocates that the effects of climate change and any proposed solutions must be viewed through the lens of racial and economic inequities. The movement emerged in the 1980s as evidence began mounting that Black communities and communities of color in general were disproportionately being affected by global warming. Bullard's awakening about environmental justice happened in the late 70s when his wife, Linda McKeever Bullard, a lawyer, became involved in a class action lawsuit brought by Black homeowners in Houston. The 1979 suit, Bean v. Southwestern Waste Management Corp., challenged plans to establish a municipal landfill in the plaintiff's neighborhood. Bullard, a sociology professor at the time, launched an expansive research project to document the locations of all the landfills and waste incineration plants in Houston, a city with no zoning laws. He and his students pored through city records, census data, and archival documents from the 1930s to 1978 and found that 100% of city-owned landfills and 3 out of 4 privately owned landfills were in black neighborhoods. 83% of all the waste dumped in Houston from the 1930s was in black neighborhoods, even though black people made up only 25% of the population. The court ruled in favor of Southwestern Waste Management, but the movement galvanized Bullard. Yet when he took his findings to environmental and civil rights groups, Bullard said he was met with a lack of support. "That was an eye-opening moment for me," he said. "There was no environmental justice movement in 1979. We had white environmental groups that didn't understand the issue and the injustice. But we also had black civil rights organizations that didn't think it was part of their agenda. But even if the problems weren't getting officially recognized, the idea of environmental racism was beginning to bubble up in certain parts of the country. In 1987, the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice, led by Benjamin Chavez, published a seminal report on toxic waste and race in the U.S. titled Toxic Waste and Race in the United States. The report found that 3 out of every 5 black and Hispanic Americans lived in communities with uncontrolled toxic waste sites. The authors wrote that the research exposed a serious void in present government programs addressing racial and ethnic concerns in this area. A movement was born. 4 years later, 1991, Chavez spearheaded the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit in Washington, D.C. The meeting gathered together academics and leaders from black, Latino, Native American, and Asian American communities. Bullard was among the attendees of the 4-day conference. The representatives drafted 17 principles of environmental justice that formed the foundation of a movement. That same year, several environmental justice pioneers co-signed a letter to the 10 largest white-led environmental organizations in the country, including the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Resource Defense Council, and the Sierra Club. The letter called out the lack of diversity among the group's staff and boards of directors and in their missions. It challenged these organizations to live up to the ideals, Bullard said. If they are about protecting the environment, they should be talking about protecting the environment for everybody, not just white middle-class elites. Fred Krupp, who at the time was executive director of the Environmental Defense Fund, said the moment was a wake-up call. "When that letter was sent, our staff wasn't diverse and our board wasn't diverse," he said. "It did cause us to stop and think about things differently." "Those changes weren't enough," said Krupp, who is now president of the Environmental Defense Fund. "The events of the past week have demonstrated that mainstream environmental groups have plenty more work to do, including efforts to rebuild trust in marginalized communities. There's a lot more room for us to partner with frontline groups and bring what we can to the table to support their work," Krupp said. "That's the way you build trust, because mere words or statements or social media posts are woefully inadequate. The NAACP is one of the groups with the biggest presences on the front line of environmental activism. Bullard credits Patterson of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program with much of the progress that has been made in prioritizing climate justice as one of the civil rights group's core missions. Patterson said many climate change organizations and environmental leaders are still slow to fully embrace intersectionality as part of their mission. Part of the struggle likely owes to how the modern environment movement evolved," she said. The roots of the traditional environmental movement came out of conservation of flora, fauna, and wild spaces, he said. "It's a pretty big shift for these people to think about human rights and the way that environmental racism affects communities. The concept of environmentalism, which can be traced to the late Middle Ages in Europe, was hardly built on principles of equality. Rather, early conservationists largely campaigned to keep forests and parks pristine for their own elite enjoyment," according to Joyce Chaplin, a professor of early American history at Harvard University. "Overwhelmingly, the conservation that was done favored powerful people," she said. "The classic example would be the forests that were conserved for hunting game as private entertainment for aristocrats and monarchs." Similar dynamics drove conservation efforts in the U.S. in the early 20th century and influenced the thinking and research of early giants in the movement, including President Theodore Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot, the man he named Chief Forester of the redefined U.S. Forest Service. The ideas about which communities benefit from conservation and national parks basically builds from old European logic about who is privileged enough to go walk among the trees, Chaplin said. "That legacy persists today, whether or not people realize it," said Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, a marine biologist who is the founder and CEO of Ocean Collective, a science and public policy consulting firm, and the Urban Ocean Lab, a think tank for coastal cities. There's so many people who care about justice and care about climate change, but they still don't get it. They still don't see the connection, she said. It's not like the climate community has a problem with wild racists and horrible people. These are the good ones, and they're still not quite there. Johnson wrote an essay last week in the Washington Post about the difficulties of existing beneath the layers of existential crises caused by climate change and racism. Climate change can't be solved, she argued, without also addressing racial justice. I understand the instinct to want to focus just on climate change because that's already so complicated, she said. But that's naive because it implies that these issues are not inextricably interwoven. And the links can't be overlooked because many of the climate risks faced by black communities and other communities of color are magnified because of other deep-seated social and economic issues. When America has a cold, black folks have the flu, said the Reverend Michael Malcolm, executive director of Alabama Interfaith Power and Light, a religious organization based in Birmingham that aims to mobilize congregations through Alabama to address climate change. In addition to helping communities build strategies to increase energy efficiency and shrink their emissions output, the organization also advocates for policy changes at the state level to combat global warming and environmental racism. Malcolm said his work in the community demonstrated that socioeconomic issues, health issues, and climate issues can't be divorced from one another. Three words connect it all. I can't breathe, Malcolm said, referring to George Floyd's final words as a white Minneapolis police officer dug his knee into his neck for more than 8 minutes. Whether it's the pressure we felt through policy, or the violence we face from people who are supposed to protect and serve us, or the brutality we face from pollution, it has always been, I can't breathe. But Malcolm said this moment in history feels different, and he's hopeful that mass protests in almost every major city in the country, as well as the widespread calls for reform, will lead to lasting change. Bullard agreed, saying the intergenerational makeup of the people protesting and demanding change fuels his optimism. Youth and student-led movements have played important roles in changing the course of the country throughout history, and he is more than happy to welcome a new generation into the fight for environmental justice. I've been doing this for 40-plus years, and I've always said that when you fight for justice, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, he said. But it's actually more of a marathon relay. You run your 26.2 miles, and then you pass the baton on to the next generation. Okay, next up, continuing with this theme from Grist. Responding to protests, green groups reckon with racist past. Already stressed by the threat of coronavirus and widespread unemployment, the United States has erupted into protests after the killing of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, by a Minneapolis police officer. Now, prominent groups in the environmental movement, which has long struggled with a dark racist past, are speaking out against institutional prejudice and calling for the movement to better prioritize social justice. For too long, conservation and environmental movements have not spoken up to address the long-standing challenges that non-white communities face, Fred Krupp, the president of the Environmental Defense Fund, said in a statement. Environmental organizations should work to bring down the barriers that affect black, people of color, and indigenous communities. The League of Conservation Voters, Earth Justice, 350.org, and the Sierra Club also issued statements condemning the killing of George Floyd and vowing to work towards racial justice. There is no just recovery for climate without addressing the systemic extraction, harm, and violence towards black communities, said 350.org in a statement on its website. For the past few decades, green groups have been working to overcome the racist history of the environmental movement. Early conservationists were sometimes overtly racist, espousing white supremacy, encouraging the use of eugenics. In the 1960s and 70s, many mainstream environmentalists were preoccupied with concerns over runaway population growth. Prominent thinkers like Garrett Hardin and Paul Ehrlich encouraged sterilization programs. Hardin even suggested withholding food aid to developing countries during famines to cull global population. Even when such blatant racism began to wane, many environmental groups, which tended to focus on wildlife and land conservation, continued to ignore issues that disproportionately impacted communities of color, like air pollution, water security, and extreme weather. Meanwhile, the leadership, staff, and volunteers of green organizations remained overwhelmingly white. That may be beginning to change. According to a study published last week in the academic journal PLOS ONE, many environmental non-governmental organizations around the world are moving beyond conservation to focus on climate politics and environmental justice. A few months ago, the Green 2.0 initiative, which tracks racial and gender diversity in the environmental movement, found that people of color have increased on the staffs and boards of major green groups in the United States. Meanwhile, black and Latino communities in the United States are increasingly taking matters into their own hands. The number of organizations specifically focused on environmental justice is on the rise, and some have connected the fight for cleaner air and healthier communities with issues of police brutality and oppression. When we say, I can't breathe, whether it is an officer with a knee on their neck or the pollution which continues to take away our breath, that's why we march and that's why we work so hard to change these dynamics, said Mustafa Santiago Ali, Vice President of Environmental Justice at the National Wildlife Federation. Ultimately, activists say mainstream environmental groups will have to do a lot more than make statements in solidarity if they truly want to help address America's institutional racism. Only a small sliver of the billions of dollars flowing to the environmental sector in the U.S. goes to jobs focused on justice, said Jose Bravo, executive director of the San Diego-based Just Transition Alliance. We need to share those resources, he added. Adding that equity for people of color needs to be more than just a sidebar for mainstream environmentalists. Environmental justice needs to be at the forefront of what's being done and what's being advocated for. Okay, and I'm going to close the show with an article punctuating the need for climate justice being racial justice as well. This from EE News. Population of top 10 counties for disasters, 81% minority. Communities with large minority populations are among the most vulnerable in the U.S. to the effects of climate change and could become more threatened as the coronavirus pandemic weakens their resilience to disasters, according to experts and federal data. Counties, cities, and neighborhoods with large numbers of Black and Hispanic residents are more likely than others to suffer from events such as extreme heat and flooding because they are often located in damage-prone areas and frequently lack the resources to recover quickly from disasters. It's a result of long-lived policies that clustered minorities in undesirable areas such as floodplains and denied them amenities like green spaces and tree canopies that can mitigate some effects of climate change. Communities of color and low-income neighborhoods are disproportionately at risk from climate crisis, said Kate Mingoya, who has studied the environmental effects of housing discrimination as director of capacity building at Groundwork USA, a national nonprofit. We can really face the ugly truth that there were policies of intentionally putting low-income people and people of color in neighborhoods that were dangerous. Federal data confirms the risk facing those communities. In the 10 counties that are deemed most vulnerable to disasters by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the population is on average 81% minority. In the top 10 counties rated as the most vulnerable to extreme heat, the population is on average 67% minority. Minorities account for 39% of the U.S. population. The federal government's 2018 National Climate Assessment underscored the risk of minority neighborhoods, saying that vulnerable people, including lower income and other marginalized communities, have lower capacity to prepare for and cope with extreme weather and climate-related events that are expected to experience greater impacts. Data collected by the Federal Emergency Management Agency suggests Black communities already have suffered disproportionately from hurricanes, floods, and other major disasters. FEMA has distributed $22 billion in emergency funding since 2004 to people in areas that were hit by major disaster and declared eligible for federal aid. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention rates each county's vulnerability to disaster by analyzing data such as income and education levels, single-parent households, race and ethnicity that indicate a county's ability to recover from major disruption. Nearly 24% of that $22 billion in emergency funding went to people in zip codes where a majority of the population is Black, according to an EE News analysis of FEMA records. These majority Black zip codes account for just 6% of the overall U.S. population. The cash payments are separate from the money FEMA gives to states for rebuilding damaged infrastructure. Their allocation reflects both the concentration of damage in minority areas and the economic fragility of neighborhoods. If you are in an affluent area, you have insurance, said Beverly Wright, executive director of the New Orleans-based Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. Hurricanes can affect anybody and everyone, but it's the ability to rebound that is so important. In New Orleans, Wright of the Center for Environmental Justice has watched a tree planting project help transform the city's gentrifying Gentilly neighborhood. That's going in an area that, for the most part, where white people have gentrified. Black people don't live there anymore, Wright said of the area where trees are being planted. Neighborhood beautification always seems to stop at the point where the income goes down and the color of people living in these changes. It's just amazing how endemic racism works. Somehow, it always stops just before it benefits us. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to review this show, listen to any previous shows, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.